involves a lot of detective work and sleuthing. Is that how you see it in your practice too? That part of what you're doing is reorienting person to try to find the cause, that it's at the bottom of things?
That's exactly right. And when people come in with allergies, of course, often they're associated with other problems in their health. It might be fatigue. It might be chronic sinus infections. It may be some serious autoimmune disease. And often at the root of it is an immune system imbalance, of which allergies are the sort of most superficial manifestation. So we take our patients through a series of steps in an evaluation to look at what role is the diet playing? What role is the digestion playing? What role is the adrenal gland function playing? What role are hidden infections in the body playing? Because what we're finding more and more as we do more of these cultures of the nasal secretions and the throat, that there are often hidden infections in the body that are the key to reducing this total antigenic load, which can free people from allergy symptoms in the spring.
If you just tuned in, we're talking today with Dr. Gary Weiner, naturopathic physician and acupuncturist, about how to address your spring allergies. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 503-231-8187. So assuming that you were wondering whether a specific patient might have foods that they're eating that may be giving them actual respiratory symptoms or making them more vulnerable to respiratory allergies, how do you in your practice go about figuring out whether that's true or not?
Well, the first thing you do with a patient is simply listen to what they're eating day in and day out. And, you know, it isn't rocket science these days with all the literature out there and all the studies that there's a large group of allergenic foods that seem to promote allergy. You know, foods like dairy products and gluten products. Now, not everybody is sensitive to everything, but patients often choose to either have some sort of a lab test which can identify food allergies, or, you know, a simple peel-back elimination diet of really cleaning up. You know, spring is a great time for detoxification, and nothing like a 10-day to 2-week detox program to peel back the food allergens and see if symptoms change. And then you can add them back one by one and see what's really causing the problem.
And in some people, you find that food could be the entire issue, and for other people, it might be almost none of the issue in terms of their spring symptoms, I would guess.
For some people, food is everything. And then, of course, you know, there are people who come in with what seems like a perfect diet who have, you know, just terrible hay fever and allergic symptoms. And as we look further, sometimes we find a low-level chronic sinus infection that needs to be taken care of. Sometimes the adrenal function, the anti-inflammatory, anti-allergic hormone cortisol is shown to be very low on a lab test. Sometimes we'll find some big population of bacteria in the intestine itself, or digestive problems that when we focus on those, allergy symptoms go away. Now, of course, you know, everybody wants relief, and so do I when I have allergy symptoms. So there's lots of good remedies out there that we can use in the short term while we work on the root.
And this, to go further with this digestion, respiratory connection, What do you think the reason is, say, one person who gives up wheat and all of a sudden they don't get their chronic sinusitis when they're going through the hay fever season, when the trigger, you know, on the most obvious level is the pollen or the grass, but then turns out they get rid of the wheat and then they don't manifest the symptoms from the pollen and the grass? Do you think it's they're not going over a certain threshold around certain inflammatory pathways, or is there something else going on there?
Well, there is a mechanism that's been studied called intestinal permeability, and these little microscopic holes in the intestine that are caused by eating something that your body really wants to get rid of, and when you continue to eat that wheat, you get what's called a leaky gut, and then you've got these proteins that are floating around in the blood, and wherever you have a weakness in your system, in many people it's the sinuses and all these cavities in the face, you will have a reaction because of all these food proteins that are floating around in the blood, and when they cross these surfaces, you have a manifestation. When you eliminate that weed, those holes patch up. They self-repair, as it were. And when you're walking through the grove in the forest, you no longer react to those pollens, because those pollens were just the tip of an iceberg. And now you've lowered the load, and so the threshold is much, 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 much higher.
So you mentioned some options for short-term remedies, you know, people finding ways to deal with their symptoms while they look at the underlying cause. What are some of your more tried and true remedies that you'll first suggest to somebody?
Well,
by and large,
bioflavonoids and bioflavonoids are a compound that's available in supplements that's, of course, readily available if you eat lots and lots of skins of fruits like berries. Bioflavonoids with quercetin, which is one kind of flavonoid, and vitamin C combined with just a little diet change, perhaps removing what's called the ragweed of food, dairy products for a couple of weeks, really helps. You know, nettles tea works for some, not for all, probably because of the ability of nettles to neutralize histamine reactions.
Do you use astragalus-based formulas much? I know that's usually the first thing I pull off my shelf when I'm dealing with symptom management, are astragalus-based formulas. I was curious if in your practice you found that similarly or not.
I certainly use astragalus in some Chinese formulas as a Chinese herbalist, but I've never used astragalus alone. That's good to know.
We're talking today with Dr. Gary Weiner, who's talking today about ways to determine what is going on beneath your spring allergy symptoms. If you'd like to join the conversation on Health Watch, the number is 503-231-8187. So there are other causes other than digestion that could be leading to allergy symptoms. And you mentioned the adrenal glands. What is the connection to the adrenal glands, and what would a patient who had a primarily an adrenal gland problem related to their allergies look like?
Well, you know, the adrenal gland makes the hormones that control blood sugar in the body, inflammation, and neutralize the negative effects of stress. So there's often a stressy picture in such a patient who doesn't respond to stress well, who's tired from some traumatic events, or who's just tired from life. Often fatigue is a main component of that. And they have a poor ability to deal with anything stressful in their life, is a typical picture. And the connection is that if we didn't have adequate amounts of adrenal hormones floating around in our body, in our bloodstream, we would be having allergic reactions all day long. I think all of us take for granted the fact that adequacy in our hormones is actually preventing us from reacting more to things. So the connection is this hormone cortisol is absolutely vital to quelling local inflammations, especially in these sort of these mucous surfaces that comprise our nose and our eyes and our sinuses. And when you bring that level up, either through hormone supplementation or through using herbal formulas and stress reduction techniques and things that both you and I do in our practices, like acupuncture and counseling to patients to find a different way of responding to the stresses in their life, that the allergies start to disappear, the allergy symptoms. If you combine that with treating that undiagnosed hidden infection and detoxing generally and doing some diet change, you start to approach something like a cure for this occurrence that happens every spring, or for a lot of people who have allergy symptoms all year long, not just in the spring.
Sure, there's definitely people who have allergies all through the winter to molds and all sorts of other things in Oregon.
But, you know, we always focus on the spring. But you and I both know that, yeah, there people are coming in all year round. And the other thing is that you know, there's a rise in serious autoimmune conditions. You know, we treat more and more Graves' disease and Hashimoto's and rheumatoid arthritis. And we've all found, who do the kind of work that you and I do, that when we look at decreasing allergy expression in the body, that autoimmune diseases improve. So I think that the tendency in the spring, it holds a little key, a little gem, as it were. If we don't block it out, you know, block it out with suppressive medicine all the time. And when you have to do it, you have to do it, I suppose. But what the Chinese understood very well is that when you trap an allergen in the body by blocking its exit with the kind of medical approach, you lock the thief in the house. And that's the last thing you want to do if you really want to achieve wellness in your life.
We should probably also mention that other respiratory allergies can make your spring allergies worse, I would imagine, such as if you have an allergy to your pet or to your pillow or to your mattress. I would think that some of those environmental exposures would be something you'd want to also look at if you're wanting to minimize your allergies to pollen.
Well, part of a good root assessment of allergies is to look at the whole environmental load in the body. That's going to include what's going on in your home in terms of your bedding and your carpets, as well as, you know, things that might be accumulating in your body like heavy metals. Certainly when you clean up the diet, you're cleaning up food additives and chemicals and pesticides from eating things that don't belong. You know, the average slice of bread today, of commercial bread, and I'm sure most of your listeners don't eat that kind of bread, have 100 ingredients. You know, a piece of bread should have, you know, 5 ingredients in it. And, you know, people who are eating the standard American diet are really holding a huge load. And when they clean that up, it's really a joy to see. You know, I could pull 20 cases out of my file in recent years of kids from who live in the country and live on farms with farm animals, and the complaint is they can't play with the animals because of the asthma and the eczema and the sneezing. And we work on some of these underlying causes, and they're fine with the animals, and that's because we've cleaned up the scene. And the spring is a great time to do that.
So are you a proponent of any of the home hydrotherapy methods, whether it be like a neti pot or a saltwater wash of the sinuses or steam inhalation or gargling, things that people can do to keep things sterile in the sinus cavities?
Absolutely. I mean, it's never cured them in my experience, but it's, you know, we're trying to send everybody home with something that they can do in the home, and it's good to sprinkle a little bit of good bacteria in that sinus wash and send it up the nose with a neti pot. The home hydrotherapy moves the energy in the body, you know, the so-called wet socks or the alternating hot and cold. You know, the Chinese understood well that the spring is the season of the liver, when all these symptoms manifest, and the liver is in charge of coursing and draining and keeping the qi, or the energy in the body, flowing. And these hydrotherapy treatments do that really well, and it's something people can do without going out and spending lots of money on qi-moving therapies like acupuncture.
Let's take our first call. Welcome to Health Watch. You're on the air with Dr. Gary Weiner.
Yes. I had a question. I didn't acquire allergies, hay fever, seasonally until I was in my 20s, and I'm in my 40s now. And I was wondering that if you develop seasonal hay fever later on in life, can you assume that that's attributed to diet? And also, how does alcohol affect allergies?
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think you can make that assumption about, you know, age and that it's diet. You know, with age and life, lots of things are changing. We're dynamic beings, and due to stress, you could have a lower adrenal function. You may have acquired some low-level infection. You may be holding more of an antigenic load than you did when you were younger, or it could be diet. And what was that second question?
About alcohol.
Oh, alcohol. I think alcohol is definitely on a list of foods due to its high content of sugars. It's definitely on a list of very, very high up in the allergen list. It's a very allergenic food, and it does seem to increase hay fever symptoms in most.
I'll just say from my practice, I see lots of people who are who inexplicably all of a sudden develop allergy symptoms at some random point in their life, or the reverse. Someone hits menopause and all of a sudden they don't have their hay fever anymore. No one knows exactly why that's the case, but they seem to be able to appear and disappear in some people without an obvious immediate trigger. We've talked a lot about spring cleansing, Dr. Weiner. Can we talk a little bit more about what that might involve? You mentioned pulling out a list of potential allergenic foods. Are there other things people would take to assist sort of like liver detoxification or other things when they're going through a cleanse?
Well, there's lots of ways to cleanse. I think our favorite cleansing regimens involve a kind of serial removal of food groups over the course of a couple of weeks. You know, we might begin with just getting out the so-called junk, and then the next day pull out the dairy and then the next day pull out the gluten, and the next day pull out the nuts and seeds, and the next day pull out the rest of the grains, or did we pull out the gluten yet? I'm not sure, but
would you add things?
And then as we're removing food serially, we increase taking, usually in the form of some sort of a shake with lots of liver cleansing herbs and what are called precursors that push this liver detox process. Usually, people lose weight, allergy symptoms move away as the digestion gets very simplified. In fact, for a couple of days in our detox, they're just eating apples and pears and cruciferous vegetables and drinking about 700 calories in a shake and pushing the really, really supporting the liver and then adding food slowly back. And then at the end of that, we have a good understanding of what happened and how much better people are, and then we try to, you know, sort of incorporate some level of these changes into their life.
And I'd imagine somebody where digestion is a bigger part of the picture, say, versus adrenal glands, would get more better on that protocol than somebody where digestion or food wasn't a big part of the picture.
That's right. And people with serious health conditions that we're working on at the same time, you know, we're probably going to be doing more of a laboratory assessment because there's a lot at stake here. So we can really look at the hidden infections with laboratory. We can look at adrenal function with laboratory. We can look at heavy metal accumulation with laboratory and so on.
So it looks like there's quite a few options and also quite a few potential culprits involved in this.
That's right. You know, it can be as simple as a fairly superficial reactivity to a high pollen count combined with some stress in your life. It can be as simple as a diet shift solving the whole problem, or in some cases it can be a complex web that needs to be sorted out. And you know, I think the beautiful thing about Chinese medicine and how contemporary naturopathy, which both you and I practice, has married to that philosophy to have a look at the role of the lungs, the digestion, the liver, and other organs in the body, including the kidneys, to have a full understanding of how this symphony orchestra of our health plays.
So if listeners today were interested in finding out more about how you lead people to discover what's underneath their allergies or how to do a spring cleanse, Do you have either a website or a phone number people could look at?
Absolutely. Our website is www.pearlnaturalhealth.com. That's pearlnaturalhealth.com. And our phone number is 503-230-8973. And on our website, you can go to Conditions We Treat, Allergies, and you'll find some more information about what we're doing.
Well, looks like we're going to squeeze one last caller in before the bottom of the half hour. Welcome to Health Watch. You're on the air with Dr. Gary Weiner, and if you could keep your question brief, that would be great.
Yes, I just have a question about helping to treat young people. I have an 8-year-old boy who has allergies in the spring and also eczema, and I wondered, beyond the nettles tea, if your guest has suggestions.
Well, thank you for the call. I don't know if you caught all of today's program, but if you didn't catch all of today's program, it's going to be archived later today, and you can actually hear a lot of what we went through about it. I think we lost our listener. Okay, we lost our listener. But, so people are interested in hearing the entire program today with Dr. Gary Weiner. If you tuned in partway through, later today or tomorrow, you'll be able to go to kboo.fm/healthwatch, and that show and all of the previous Health Watch shows are archived, and you can listen to them there or download them onto your computer. Thanks again for being on Health Watch, Dr. Gary Weiner.
Thank you, David.
So we've been talking today with Dr. Gary Weiner, local naturopath and acupuncturist at Pearl Natural Health. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning Radio Zine.
Already qualified to help us change the world. Join us at our next volunteer orientation on Monday, April 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue here at your community radio station, KBOO.
Mellow Mood Fridays, a live reggae music series, March 28th, April 4th, and 11th. Featuring artists Synergy, Adrian Xavier, The Rising Buffalo Tribe, Positive Vibes, Papa Wastik, Jesse Genda, Archangel, and the African Foundation Crew. Roots, Reggae, and Dancehall. Jamaican, African, regional, and island vibes, dancing, and positive community times. For more information, visit hawthornetheater.com. Sponsored by Mellow Mood Pipe, Mike Thrasher presents KBOO Community Radio, Just Some Reggae Folk, and EMET events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is David Healy. David is a professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University in Wales, and he's published more than 200 peer-reviewed articles in scientific journals, as well as being author of more than 22 books. He's also the co-founder of a new organization, risk.org. So welcome to Madness Radio, David Healy.
Well, it's good to be here.
David, it's really great to have you on the show. Your published books and articles are a wealth of information, critical of psychiatry, critical of the pharmaceutical industry, and you've done a tremendous amount of work in making drugs safer for people. So I really want to congratulate you and honor you for your leadership in this field and welcome you to the show. And I just wanted to start out by just, if you could just say a little bit about your own background. How is it that you became interested in pharmacology, and what was it that maybe alerted you that there were such big problems in the field and got you started on the path of being something of a crusader?
I think the main reason to get interested in pharmacology was back when I went into the mental health field first. This was the early 80s. The drugs looked like a good tool to probe the brain and how it works, to help us understand why we think and feel and behave the way we do. Okay, it looked like it would shed light on how the brain supports the mind. Okay, now in terms of becoming a crusader, I don't think I am. At least that's not the way I've viewed things. The way I've viewed things, I think from early on, I would have thought I was a fairly conservative and fairly straight doctor, you know, who viewed pills as possible poisons that could cause problems. But what I think I've found is that the field seems to have been moving away from me rather than me moving away from the field. Over the last 20 to 30 years or so, what I think we've seen is a change in the attitude many doctors have towards pills. Well, once they regarded them as poisons, which could be awfully helpful, but needed to be used with care, they've tended increasingly to view them as fertilizers, that they should be used as much as you can, that you should spread the fertilizer as widely as you can. And the place, I guess, where this comes out most clearly is in the case of children. 20 to 30 years ago, there's no way that anyone would have thought that it was a good idea to put huge numbers of children on antidepressants, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, and things like this. And it's not just those drugs, it's all kinds of drugs. We didn't see the same number of kids on asthma drugs, on statins and drugs like this either. So there's that. But there's also a thing that became a little clearer to me as well. 20 to 30 years ago or so, nobody would have thought that it was quite likely that most of the literature that we have on drugs and how they work is actually being ghost-written. This would have been inconceivable to most people.
Can you explain a little bit about what ghost-writing is in pharmaceutical studies?
Most people looking at a journal like the New England Journal of Medicine or the British Journal of Psychiatry or the American Journal of Psychiatry see all these articles there, which are authored, it seems, by the biggest names in the field, professors of medicine or professors of psychiatry in Yale and Harvard and various other institutions. And most of us 20 to 30 years ago would have figured that these people wrote those articles. I mean, if it appears in a journal like the New England Journal of Medicine, it absolutely has to be an honest article. But in fact, it's now clear that pretty well all the articles that deal with drugs that are on patent across medicine, this isn't just, you know, the mental health field, this is true for respiratory medicine and cardiac medicine and other areas also, that pretty well all these articles are ghostwritten. That is, they've been written within the pharmaceutical company, in essence, or by a ghostwriter who's working for a company, a medical writing company that works to the pharmaceutical industry. And what they've done is they've been given part of the data from the clinical trial that's on this drug, and they've been asked to produce an article that will help sell the pill. They'll often or usually have certain commercial objectives for the article. That is, the company wants this article to appeal to a particular group of doctors. And the job of, you know, the ghostwriter is to make the drug look good and to hide the problems. Now, they can do this job extraordinarily well, sometimes to the point where they can take a negative trial of the drug. That's a trial where the drug has failed. And by clever use of words and data, they can make it appear as though the drug has, in fact, worked well in this particular clinical trial. And also, they've got ways to hide the adverse events that may have happened in the actual trial. For instance, they may indicate in the article that they're only going to report on the adverse events that occur at a 10% rate or more, when conveniently, for instance, in this particular trial, it could have been that the rate at which children became suicidal happened at a 9% rate. I mean, they aren't actually lying, but they do omit the crucial material that the average doctor who's going to use the pill needs to have, and more to the point, the crucial material that any of the rest of us that may be put on these pills needs to have.
And so 20 years ago, when you entered the field, this would have been considered just outrageous.
Yes, the view that most doctors would have had back then, in fact, all of us would have had back then, was that it was inconceivable that people like me who've done clinical trials would allow a thing like this to happen. The whole process that led to this happening probably started around the early 80s, and it was only around 15 to 20 years ago or so that people began to realize that it was happening. For the most part, most doctors still don't realize that it's happening. They still think that the articles that they see in the biggest journals in the field are genuine articles rather than advert for the pill.
So why is it that you think that you sort of kept your original perspective on what was right in the field, whereas other doctors just kind of went along with this shift to ghostwriting and misleading about the dangers of medications?
Why have most doctors slipped into a collusion with things, and I haven't? That's a little hard to answer. Partly, perhaps, it may be linked to the fact that back in the 1990, after the SSRIs had come on the market in the UK first, I was among the first people who would have used these drugs, put people on them.
So these are the SSRIs, the antidepressants like Prozac and Paxil and Effexor?
Yes. And putting people on these drugs, they were, the pills did help some, but they also made other people anxious and nervous and become suicidal. This seemed very obvious and clear to me, but when I tried to report it, when I tried to write it up as an article to outline what could happen on these pills, when I tried to talk to colleagues about what I was seeing happen, the response I got was that people just didn't believe it. I was being told that, you know, you're just wrong. The things that you say you're seeing in front of your eyes, that these just aren't happening. Now, I don't think I'm a good person. I don't think I'm better than any of the other doctors that have closer links to industry now than I have. But what I think I am is a slightly stubborn person. And when I'm being told that the white I can see in front of me is actually black, I tend to dig my heels in and say, well, no, it's white. And I think that's probably what happened. And in order to try and support the evidence of my own eyes, I came to doubt the evidence that other people were offering me. I mean, what we've had is a world where 30 to 40 years ago, if a doctor put you on a pill and you and they saw a thing happening to you, both of you tended to believe that the drug could cause it. And the usual response was to halt the pill. And if the problem cleared up, most people agreed the drug had caused it. But increasingly, with